Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
I have never quite understood why, at least in the English-speaking world, they call the occasion coming 2 days from now a Good Friday. It might just as well be called Solemn Friday or Tragic Friday or Heart-Wrenching Friday, but it is the occasion of, the anniversary, so to speak, of the crucifixion, though things look much better 3 days later in the standard Christian tradition. We are going to be talking about the real man, Jesus, as he is knowable. And how knowable is he is a crucial question. My two guests are both New Testament scholars, long focused on the attempt to recover the actual facts about the earthly career of Jesus, as well as connect that career to the Christian faith that both of them do, in fact, represent. They are Klein Snodgrass, who's been here many times before. He is professor of New Testament Studies at North Park University. And visiting us for the first time is Barbara Reed, who is a Dominican sister and is professor of New Testament Studies and also vice president and academic dean at the Catholic Theological Union. I want to give you a quotation to begin with and get your reaction to it. This fellow, not unknown in more recent history, says, "I know men, and I tell you that Jesus Christ is no mere man. Between him and every other person in the world, there is no possible term of comparison. Alexander, Caesar, Charlemagne, and I have founded empires. But on what did we rest the creation of our genius? Upon force. Jesus Christ founded his empire upon love, and at this hour millions of men would die for him." Can you imagine or guess who that is? It's Napoleon. So he sees Jesus as conqueror. And through the eyes of a conqueror, surely Jesus was a conqueror. One rather remembers the line attributed to that Roman heretic, who was he, who tried to put down Christianity but failed. What was it? Galilean, thou hast conquered. Which emperor was that?
Not sure on the quotation.
Somebody will tell us. At any rate, I'm talking too much and haven't given you yet a chance to respond. How does one go about knowing the man who lived a mortal life in ancient Israel over 2,000 years ago? How does one go about reconstructing it and getting to the facts?
Well, one of the first things to recognize is the nature of what we have, the sources that we have about Jesus, mm-hmm. are three stages removed from the real Jesus. And so it's very important to remember that the Bible is not an eyewitness historical account, but is three stages away from what really happened.
Why do you say three stages?
Well, the first stage is what Jesus really did and said.
Uh-huh.
And then the second stage is, for several decades, the early followers of Jesus passed on the tradition orally in preaching, teaching, retelling the mm-hmm. stories. And then it's only in several decades down the line that they start collecting some of the sayings of Jesus, the miracles of Jesus. Probably one of the first pieces to be solidified was the Passion narrative. And so it's not until around 70 that the first gospel that we have in the mm-hmm. Bible, the Gospel of Mark, is probably the earliest one to be written down in around the year 70. And so to peel away the layers to get to what Jesus really did and said is a bit of a trick, and there's only so far you can go with that.
When I read a book that supposedly presents to me a serious truths about an important matter, I want to know something about the author, so as to estimate whether I should or shouldn't fully trust him. What do we know about who Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were?
In any of these questions that you ask, there are a variety of answers that people give.
Yeah.
I tell my students, there are four facts, and everything else is theory. The four facts are Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And the documents, I'm talking about the documents, not the people,
yeah.
in saying something like that. And Barbara's correctly pointed to the fact that there's some distance between the writing down of the material and the event that took place. Just exactly how that happened, though, there's a great deal of disagreement about, and people are doing things today that 20 years ago, I wouldn't have thought they would have been doing. For example, a book written, large book written a couple of years ago by Richard Bauckham, focusing on the eyewitnesses of Jesus. And his argument, which may be an overstatement, but is very carefully documented, is that where people are named in the gospel accounts, they are witnesses to the event. They are specific people that are known and are carrying on that tradition. The difficulty is, though, that it's quite difficult for us to look at the documents and to be able to redo their history. And I think we need a great deal of caution in terms of what we think we know and what we say about the documents.
You carry a burden that your truly fundamentalist colleagues don't carry. They have the many of them do, have the doctrine of inerrancy, meaning every word of the Bible is ultimately true. And it is a guaranteed record of what really happened and what it really was about. I know that, and of course, Klein, you are a minister in which denomination?
I work for the Evangelical Covenant Church. My background comes out of the Baptist Church.
But you don't stand on inerrancy of
I do not. I do
New
not
Testament.
Think it's a very helpful word for a couple of reasons. We don't use it anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, if you do use it, it sends all the wrong messages. People immediately want to either say you're right or you're wrong, or what about this, what about that. It's just not it's not what the documents are about. And when I look at the Gospels, what I think we're dealing with is four interpretive pictures of Jesus.
And of course, Catholicism, modern Catholicism, does not assume inerrancy either with regard to scriptural material.
Well, some years ago there was an important document on the historical truth of the Bible, and affirming that the Bible is indeed true, but the kind of truth that it reveals is the truth that is necessary for our salvation. And so so it would not be affirming, for example, that every word is literally true, or, for example, that the world was created in 7 days is not a literal
truth. Is that a papal document you're referring to?
It was a document put out by the Pontifical Biblical Commission.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, and we've reached the ultimate moment of the first moment of truth on this program, namely it's time to stop for some commercials. That takes precedence over everything else. But when we return, the basic question that should guide us, obviously, is, so from all of the scholarly work that has accumulated over the last 2,000 years, but really more significantly the last 200 or 250, what do we now know to be the basic, more or less incontestable facts about the man Jesus and his mission and what really happened with and to him? And in pursuit of those matters, we return in just a few minutes to Barbara Reed and Klein Snodgrass. But first, these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Klein Snodgrass, professor of New Testament studies at North Park University here in Chicago, and Barbara Reed, professor of New Testament studies at the Catholic Theological Union in Chicago, in Hyde Park, in fact. Years ago, Hans Küng was a guest on this program, the great, if somewhat deviant, Catholic theologian. He was spending a semester at the University of Chicago, and we talked about the matters that we are now discussing. He's a very intense fellow and very brilliant speaker. His English is perfectly fine, though his native language is German. And he was rattling off the controversies and all the issues concerning the interpretation of the historical Jesus. And he got more and more intense with it, and then he broke out finally in a heartfelt sort of cry of pain or excitement, and he went into German. He said, "Aber wer war diesem Jesu?" But who was he, this Jesus? So I repeat, wer war diesem Jesu?
That's very difficult to answer in just a few moments.
To be sure.
We spend entire courses trying to get at that question with our students. But I think as I work with my students, the question that we ask is not only who was Jesus, looking to the world behind the text and trying to understand the real Jesus and the historical Jesus, but I think for believers, the question in front of the text of, so what does that mean for us, and how does that help us live our faith is really an even more important question. I don't think you can answer that second question, though, without answering the first question and trying to understand as best we can everything that we can possibly know about Jesus historically. There's probably only a handful of facts that everyone would agree on to say about the historical Jesus, that he was a Jew, that he spent a good part of his ministry up in the Galilee in Roman-occupied Palestine, that he was executed in Jerusalem, and that many people thought that he performed miracles and that he was an impressive teacher and preacher.
As your view of the facts, one fact you've not mentioned is that on the third day he rose from the dead.
Certainly his followers believe that he did indeed overcome death and that he rose from the dead and that God raised him. And the interpretation of that takes many different directions.
Does it? Do you mean it should not be taken literally? Rising from the dead.
I didn't say that. What I said is what I meant to say is that the resurrection of the dead, as we try to grapple with what does that mean,
mm-hmm.
we have no model of someone else to try to help us understand what that meant for him, what that meant for us. I think the Gospels are very clear in saying that his followers understood that he was alive again and that they experienced him alive in their midst and that they understood this to be the promise of what lay ahead for them too.
Mm-hmm. Someone has said no resurrection, no Christianity, but Christianity rises or falls on the validity of the story of the resurrection.
I'd say that's true. I have often said, if it were not for the resurrection, I don't think you would have ever heard of Jesus. He does not come giving some new ethic. He gives a focused ethic, but it's largely the ethic that he found in the Hebrew Scriptures. He doesn't come with a new agenda other than the one that's in the Hebrew Scriptures and focused by his preaching on the kingdom of God. So I would be quite happy to say yes.
But I'm going to give you an assignment or a challenge. Ask you to do a role play. Imagine that you are somebody who's lost faith or never had it and is totally skeptical about the resurrection, and therefore you cannot stay with or cannot accept Christianity. What would you say skeptically about the resurrection? I know it's not you talking, but you know people who talk that way.
Skeptically?
Yeah.
The way this argument usually goes is on the principle of analogy. Barbara already alluded to it. There is no other event analogous to this. And if you assume a closed universe that miracle doesn't happen, that God doesn't intervene in the world or something of that character, and I'm not sure that's the way I want to set things up, then there's no framework within which one can approach resurrection. I would suggest there's some other things that one might do, but that's usually the way people go. There's no analogous thing, and you operate as a historian. All things are related in cause and effect, and so resurrection does not take place.
Lots of stories spread around and are believed and credited, even though originally they were simply not the case. They were not true, but it is often functional and desirable, and it is problem-solving, it is reassuring. It has much payoff to believe certain kinds of stories, and this may very well be the ultimate example of a gratifying but not necessarily true story. That's what the skeptics say. You know that.
Yes.
I think that it's clear from what we have in the Gospels that the disciples experienced something,
mm-hmm.
something that was totally beyond their understanding, totally beyond what they had experienced before, totally beyond what they were expected to happen, and that the New Testament also talks about how they experienced a transformative power that enabled them to go beyond their fears and their misunderstandings and their struggle to understand, that they were that they embraced this mysterious happening and that it transformed their lives. And so something happened. And in a system of Jewish belief, it would have to have it's any existence is bodily existence, and so it's not just a nice idea that is remembered about Jesus. The bodily resurrection is key to Christian understanding.
It is indeed, and I've gone to the ultimate part of the story, but there's so much else before that. The life of Jesus, as we have it, as you well know, one of the great figures. Thinking about these matters and then summarizing them was Albert Schweitzer, who's distinguished in many ways, one of the great Bach scholars, a clergyman. What denomination was he ordained in?
He'd have been German Lutheran, I presume.
German Lutheran, probably, and a great organist and the great doctor at Lambaren in as a missionary physician in Africa. But his famous book is actually titled From Reimarus to Vreda, isn't it? From
to Vreda.
Reimarus
to
Vreda, subtitled Der Besuch dem historischen Jesu, The Search for the Historical Jesus. As he summarizes, or as others might do that same work later on, because Schweitzer's book was published in the early 1900s, I believe.
Wasn't 1901,
it? I think. 1901. What are the now incontestable facts about the life and career of Jesus of Nazareth?
Well, again, I think that they're pretty simple and basic. That he was born.
we don't really, with any certainty, have his birthday, though, do we?
No, we don't. Nor even his birthplace.
So it may not have been Nazareth.
The tradition was tradition is stronger that it's Bethlehem. But again, that's definitely linking it to Old Testament prophecies, and he's born, he grows up in the Galilee in Nazareth, he spends a good portion of his ministry there, healing, teaching, preaching, he is executed in Jerusalem, and something happens on the third day after, and it empowers his followers.
I think you're actually drawing on the Apostles' Creed.
Well, that's when you boil away all of the interpretive pieces to get to the bare facts. But that's a pretty dull story. Mm-hmm. You want the interpretive piece. You want all the rest of the story. It's what it means that is more important than trying to get at the basic bare bones.
But even with regard to the bare bones, we have virtually nothing about his career until he emerges as a preacher. Right. To be sure, we do have him as a child in the temple. Is that in all the four
Gnostic
Gospels?
Just Luke.
Just in Luke.
Right.
And apart from that, we have nothing of his. We have his birth.
Right.
And then we have the boy Jesus in the temple. And astonishing some of the rabbis. But then when do we first pick up the story again?
People estimate that it's somewhere about 27
his
AD.
Age. Yeah.
No, 27 AD.
27 AD.
He's about 30, 31 years
right.
old.
Yeah.
Because he was born before Herod the Great died in 4 BC.
He's born 3 or 4 years before the date
right.
that
and
we
calendars
commonly
set much, yeah. much later. And but I would want to emphasize that Jesus doesn't just all of a sudden plop down. He is part of the narrative of Israel. And that's one of the things I think that recent studies have emphasized, that this is he is thoroughly Jewish. There's a history of people trying to deny his Jewish roots or his Jewish character. He's thoroughly Jewish.
The Nazis put some clergymen to work doing just that.
That's right. But he takes on the story of Israel as his own story. Yeah. He embodies it in a real way. He takes on the task of Israel, I think. And I would point to a few other things that I think we can see in the picture. His preaching of the kingdom of God. His teaching in parables. In the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, about a third of what he teaches is in parables. And interestingly, I was involved with a work group for a number of years that was focused on key events in Jesus' life. And we identified 12 key events. And among those were Lord's Supper as something that was climactic and making a statement And the early church, you know, and Paul's there, it's the tradition that he received and doing that. The temple incident, I think is one of the causative factors that leads to his death.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of things like that. Everybody, whether they know how he does it or agree with it or anything else, they know he's respected as a miracle worker, an exorcist. So here's this conflict of God with evil that takes place in his own being.
There are many novelists, maybe even some historians or quasi-historians, who've tried to fill in the empty space in the narrative by imagining. One of the great ones was a great Jewish literary figure, Sholem Asch, whose book, The Nazarene, really constructs a total Jewish life for Jesus, but in considerable detail. And so many others have done that. George Moore's book, The Brook Kerith, do you know that one? That goes back to the 1870s or thereabouts. It's very evocative.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's the life of Jesus is kind of a Rorschach plot onto which you can project just about any meaning that you come up with.
Yeah. And recent attempts are not the first thing. In the second and third century, you had infancy gospels that attempted to fill in just those kinds of things. You know, there's the stories of Jesus as a little child taking clay and making birds out of them and clapping his hands and they fly away.
We're about to pause. We're a little bit late for an update on the news. But a matter of great interest to me, and I think lots of people have just followed this from a distance as mere amateurs, is the theory that developed for a while after they discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls, that maybe Jesus was in fact an Essene or went hung out at the monastery of the Essenes near the Dead Sea for a few years, and that's where ultimate Christian doctrine comes from. I know that's been discredited by now, but it's worth examining all the same. We return to Klein Snodgrass and Barbara Reed right after the update on the news from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we return to conversation with Barbara Reed, professor of New Testament Studies at the Catholic Theological Union, and Klein Snodgrass, who is the same, professor of New Testament Studies at North Park University. Karl Marx is reputed to have said in one meeting of the Second International or something, rose to the podium and said, "Je ne suis pas marxiste," I am not a Marxist. Could Jesus have said, "I am not a Christian"? He would have said it in Aramaic, which I can't do. did he know? What did he know about the consequences of what he was doing?
Oh, I would very much agree with that Jesus was not about founding a new religion. Mm-hmm. He was about calling his own Jewish people to be true to their own religion. And as Klein stressed, I also agree that that Jesus was very much a Jew and in continuity with Judaism. And so when Klein says he didn't just drop down out of nowhere, he comes from a long line of prophets and he acts as the prophets of old. And so prophets both lift up folks who are downtrodden and challenge those who have power, privilege, and status. And it's the latter who do him in the end. And so that his followers would eventually become separate from Judaism, I think would be nothing that Jesus had envisioned.
One English divine, I forget what his name was, a theologian of some sort, did a book about St. Paul, which he titles The First Christian. Is that a fair designation?
I would say no. First of all, I think we need to remember that the title Christian was first a pejorative term in its use. I think it only occurs three times in the New Testament, and it was not what Christians called themselves. They referred to themselves as the Way or just as the ones of Jesus or ones of the Lord or something of that character. And it's important to focus on what Jesus was doing. The line that is often used these days is that Jesus was reconstituting Israel under his own leadership. He was intending to develop a community, but not something that broke with Judaism. And indeed, I think one of the things that's really sad is the antipathy, the chasm that exists between present Judaism and present Christianity. Christians stand on their Jewish roots, and they need to realize that and embody in many ways a Jewish hope.
Well, one cannot avoid, as an historical reality, the fact of anti-Semitism.
Terrible.
Christian anti-Semitism, which has been there and is still there in some centers or some circles, but surely was there from the common interpretation is that it's based upon or it refers back to the scene of the trial before Pontius Pilate and the Jewish elders or the priests saying, let the guilt be upon us, as they urge Pilate to go forward and to execute Jesus.
And I don't think it's necessary for us to say, oh, well, the Jews didn't have any involvement. I think they did, the Jewish leaders. And people need to be careful when they read the New Testament to notice that often when the Jews are referred to in a pejorative way, it's not talking about the Jewish nation. It is indeed talking about Jewish leaders.
Yeah. And they need that seems to be what Paul himself does in some of his epistles. Do you agree?
I'm sorry?
Paul often refers to the Jews rather negatively, and it is assumed that he's talking about the Sanhedrin and people of that degree of elevation.
Yeah, and of course he defends what he's doing because he himself is a Jew, and he's very proud about being a Jew. And when he asked specifically the question, did God reject his people, he said, no way. So he would not accept this supersessionist idea that Christians have replaced Jews.
I said before we stopped for a break that I wanted to get you talking, about the Essenes and the theory that Jesus was shaped in his theology by the Essenes. That's now discredited, I guess. For a while, that was taken seriously.
Well, taken seriously by some people. One of the benefits of Qumran is that we see how at least some Jews were interpreting Scripture and using texts that were understood eschatologically, and that's been quite helpful for us with regard to understanding the New Testament's use of the Old. But there are so many places where Jesus just doesn't fit with what people at Qumran were saying. For example, nobody at Qumran is going to say, love your enemies. Quite the contrary. They have no sympathy for what they call the seekers after the smooth things, which apparently was the Pharisees.
We should go back just a little bit or do a sidebar. Who were the Essenes? What were they?
Do you want to go or you want me to?
Okay.
There are people who even question whether Qumran should be identified specifically as Essenes, but I think they should. Yeah. They are, first of all, people who belong to the priestly clan and view themselves as the people who should be in control in Jerusalem. But the high priesthood has been obtained by bribery and political machination by any number of times. And so these people go to the wilderness literally to fulfill Isaiah 40, verse 3, to be a voice crying in the wilderness to prepare the way of the Lord. And what they are doing as a community in preparing the way of the Lord is doing spiritual sacrifices by keeping law and living as a community that is extremely strict. I mean, they say if a donkey falls into a well on the Sabbath, you don't pull it out, which Jesus would have said something different. But it is a priestly clan is very strict and think that one day God will come and rescue them and defeat the Romans and they will be placed back in power. Interestingly, they have two messiahs. They have a priestly messiah and a political messiah. And there is a basis for that in the Old Testament and also in the Testament of the 12 patriarchs. But you all of a sudden you get insight into Messianic belief and expectation, which in Judaism as a whole is quite varied. And it's just quite helpful collection of text.
Sam Sandmill, who was a New Testament scholar but from a Jewish background, was at the end of his career at the University of Chicago for a few years, did a book about prophetic claimants in Israel at the time of Jesus. And he suggests there were loads of them. Jesus was not the only one.
Mm-hmm. And there are references in the New Testament too to others who claimed to be the fulfillment of Israel's hopes. And so,
I should have said messianic claims, yes, rather than merely prophetic claims.
Yes, sure. Yeah. I would agree with Klein that that it's there are too many dissimilarities between Jesus and the Essenes to identify him with Essenes. Mm-hmm. A slightly better case has been tried to be made for John the Baptist being related to the Essenes. But when we're talking about Jesus, if we have to locate him within one of the streams of Judaism of his day, he's much closer to the Pharisees than any of the others. Pharisees who were more accommodating toward who believed in oral interpretation of the law, and who were beginning to believe in resurrection. That's much closer to, if we have to put Jesus in one of the streams of his day, he's close to Phariseeism. Now, that's very shocking to most Christians, because the literary portrayal of the Pharisees in the Gospels is they are always cast as his opponents. And so it's important to recognize the nature of how the Pharisees are being used literarily in the Gospels, so that they're always the ones who are cast as the opponents.
Are the Gospels then, each of them separately, are they in some sense weapons? Are they fighting battles that we don't fully understand against religious opposition or against religious competitors?
I think I wouldn't use militaristic language to talk about them fighting battles. All what right. I would say is that each of the evangelists has his own particular lens and his own mm-hmm. particular purposes, and stressing his own particular themes for the building up of the faith of that community. Mm-hmm. And some of them would be deliberately trying to counter another position. And so there can be a polemical nature, and you can detect some of the polemicism underneath the texts in places. And certainly each is trying to present his image of Jesus for a particular purpose.
Yeah. I mentioned as we started tonight that, of course, 2 days from now is Good Friday, and the story of the trial before Pilate and the crucifixion is obviously the central story, apart from the birth narrative, perhaps. And we need to, I think, examine that. Who's that Hollywood character who did the film only a few years ago?
Mel Gibson, The Passion.
Mel Gibson's The Passion, exactly, which gives a very strong,
right,
but possibly very mistaken representation. We might talk about what we really know about that crucial day before Pontius Pilate. And we'll go on with that right after we pause for this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And so, the day of the trial and the crucifixion, this is not just what we know about Jesus, but what we know about, the plot against, or the movement against Jesus, and the culmination of his mortal career. Do we have it? I mentioned Mel Gibson. Does he draw correctly from the accounts that we do have? And for that matter, in which of the Gospels do we have the fullest account?
They're all fairly full on the crucifixion.
Yeah.
They're a little different.
But on the trial.
On the trial and the crucifixion, they both, all four of them, give a fairly extended narrative.
And the same account, basically.
Essentially. There are some differences, mm-hmm. but in all of them, it's quite clear that Jesus is crucified as a messianic pretender. He has the label King of the Jews above mm-hmm. the cross, and there is a real sense that this is a political thing that happened in terms of the Romans. I think in terms of what happens with the Jewish leaders, they see Jesus as a threat. He wants to reconstitute Israel under his leadership, and his incident in the temple, I think, is a causative factor in that. And so from the standpoint of why did he die, if you're talking about from the Roman or the Jewish standpoint, because he's a threat to the peace and security of the nation.
You know that British rabbi Schoenfield or Schoenfield some?
Hugh Schoenfield, yeah.
Schoenfield. He did a book years ago titled The Passover Plot,
right,
in which he argues that Jesus really was up to a political purpose all along, that Christians have misunderstood that this was really a political movement and they've transformed it into a new religion.
Don't we have to stop?
The point of that political movement, of course, he asserts, was to get rid of the Romans, to kick them out of Israel.
Yeah. Well, that's what people expected the Messiah would do.
Yeah.
That he would kill all the enemies and kick them out, and Jesus was clearly not that kind of Messiah. But if you ask, was Jesus political, don't we have to stop and ask, aren't all of our acts political? And is not faith in God a political act? I don't mean to say that it's counter-revolutionary, you know, we're here to change governments or something of that character. But what we do is, it does have political ramifications in terms of how we confront evil in the world. But Jesus does it from the underside. He does not come attempting to act as a powerful warrior. He comes on a donkey, making a specific statement. He comes to start a new covenant, which was Israel's promise. And he thinks by his death, I think that he's enacting that. And so, yes, in one way it's political, but not in the sense that it was understood as a threat to Rome. It was quite a different kind of threat to Rome.
Yeah, I'd like to also comment on the question that you asked a moment ago about who has the fullest account and is... And I would certainly agree with Klein that that all four tell the story in somewhat of the same contours, but the theological emphases are very different in the four accounts. And one of the important things about the way the story is told in each of the four Gospels is that the evangelists are not really intent on telling what happened for the sake of saying what happened, but they're trying to help their communities make sense of it and to elaborate some meaning to this and trying to explain how could this happen.
So what different meanings do they impute?
Well, it's if you contrast, for example, the Gospel of Mark with the Gospel of John, you get two very, very different portraits of Jesus in those two Gospels. In Mark, there's a very strong... I think pull on the suffering servant of Isaiah to portray Jesus, for example, in the trial scene. He doesn't answer back to Pilate at all. And so Isaiah 53:7, like a lamb led to the slaughter, he opens not his mouth. I think there's a deliberate way that Mark is trying to help his own community deal with suffering and deal with this by portraying Jesus, linking Jesus' story to that of the suffering servant of Isaiah. And the end of Jesus's last words in Mark, his final cry is, my God, why have you forsaken me? From Psalm 22. And there is no answer from God in that gospel until you get to the empty tomb. The Gospel of John is a very different portrait of Jesus. You have a Jesus who's very much in control, all-knowing. At the scene in the garden, he's not prostrate begging God to take the cup away if possible. Instead, he goes out to meet the arresting party. They're the ones who fall down on the ground when he reveals, "I am." He in the trial with Pilate, it's Jesus who's posing the questions to Pilate, and it's almost as if Pilate were on trial rather than Jesus. And it's almost as if Jesus is already reigning from the cross, and his final words are, "It is accomplished," or "It is finished," in John 19:30, not, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And so each of the evangelists is trying to help their communities make meaning out of this death and connect it with their own lives and their own struggles and their own ways of relying on God for help and consolation in their struggles. And the evangelists are very sparse on the details about the crucifixion itself, whether because everybody knows what's entailed in a crucifixion, or also because that's not the point of what they're trying to convey. And so that's one of the issues that I have with Mel Gibson's movie, mm-hmm. is that he puts all of the attention on the gory details, gives us very little reason why this happened to Jesus, and is not really helping us to go deeper with the theological significance.
Another quibble you could have with Mel Gibson's film, I was told by Sam Sandbell's son, who's a rabbi.
Yes, he's my colleague at CTU.
Is he now?
Yes.
I didn't realize.
Mm-hmm.
And I studied these matters. He was here discussing that film together with John Palakowski, another uh-huh. of your colleagues. And Sandbell was amused and pointed out that a basic mistake is that those Roman soldiers are talking Latin.
Yes.
When in fact, they were local guys, and mm-hmm. they would have been talking Aramaic.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose we that's not a crucial
no,
artistic license.
But to add a point to what Barbara was saying, one of the things I always found striking is the description of the crucifixion. When they actually come to describe what happened, they just say, they crucified him. Mm-hmm. That's it. You don't get a theological explanation. And you would have, you know, if I were writing the gospel, I would, at that point, I would have inserted a long theological discourse on the significance of Jesus' death. They don't do it. They are content to tell you the story and the way that he died and to focus on the resurrection. And that's all the more surprising mm-hmm. because there are at least a few sayings in the gospels where Jesus did point to his impending death and in a couple of places to its significance. But especially later in the early church, the death is the thing that they focus on, along with the resurrection, as having major theological import.
Well, that raises a tremendously significant but very naive question. I'm going to pose it as naively as I really think it. If we are trying to figure out who the historical Jesus really was, there's no doubt he was there. There's no doubt he was crucified. You can argue whether he was resurrected or not. That's the crucial item, as we agree, in Christian theology. But another fascinating question is, did Jesus fully know who he was? Did he know the significance of his death? Did he, in fact, know himself to be, quote, the Son of God, as well as the Son of Man, whatever that meant? Does he know that he is part of the eternal Godhead for a while, serving a special role on this mortal earth? Or are those, even if all of that is true, is it true but beyond what Jesus knew at the time? Is it eternally true, but something to which Jesus was not yet fully, of which he was not yet fully aware, even up to the moment of his crucifixion? Did Jesus know that he was the Jesus of Christian theology, is the question I'm raising.
Yes.
And we have to pause right now. How about that for a cliffhanger? We'll come back to it right after an update on the evening's news from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Barbara Reed and Klein Snodgrass in just a moment. But it's time now to open our phone lines and to invite you to join in the conversation. The number, as ever, 312-591-7200, 312-591-7200. For any question you want to raise, and surely there are many that come readily to mind, or for that matter, anything you want to assert or opine about, 312-591-7200. For our internet listeners at some great distance, including those on other continents, if you want to reach us, the best way, of course, is via the email, and the email address is extension720@wgnradio.com. extension720@wgnradio.com. We'll be on to the phone calls and the email in about 15 minutes at the most. Another form of the question I was trying to pose before is simply this. The triune God is conceived in many Christian theologies of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Asserts that the Son is part of a unified Godhead around which there is a great mystery and that it is, in a sense, tripartite. Did Jesus know that that's who he was?
I think that you've articulated what is later theological development. I think the historical Jesus grew in his consciousness of his special relationship with God, but he was also fully human. And so he also, through his life, was always discerning what is God asking of him. You have, for example, in Luke's gospel at the end of chapter 2, verse 52, it says, "And Jesus advanced in wisdom and age and favor before God and human beings." And so I think Luke is tipping us off there that Jesus's understanding of himself in relation to God and what his mission was something he grew in through his whole life. And so Luke in particular will portray Jesus at prayer at every major turning point. And I interpret that as Jesus needing to discern and to be in communication with God to understand what are the next steps.
So in mid-career, Jesus didn't know as much about himself and about who and what he really was as, say, the modern pope of your church knows.
Well, I would what I would say is at this point after two millennium of reflecting on Jesus, we think we have a whole lot more understanding about him
than he himself had.
I would say it's a different understanding than what he himself historically likely had of himself. I think one prime scene, for example, in the Synoptic Gospels, you have a moment in Luke's Gospel that scene in particular. It's the scene of the Transfiguration in Luke's Gospel. It says Jesus went up that mountain to pray, and it's right at the turning point where he decides to set his face to go to Jerusalem. Up until then, he's been ministering in the Galilee, and I think that moment of prayer, it is a moment of revelation. Luke's the only evangelist that tells us what was the content of the conversation with Moses and Elijah, and Moses and Elijah and Jesus are talking about his exodus, which is about to be accomplished in Jerusalem, and with that, Luke says the appearance of his face changed. It was one of those aha moments of discerning prayer where he understands that he is to go to Jerusalem to face the powers there if he's going to have the impact that he wants his ministry to have and that he understands God wants him to have. And he does get the insight, I think, that it will cost his life. But he also understands that this will be the new exodus for his people.
Very interestingly handled. I wonder, does Klein Snodgrass do with the same basic question, which is, did Jesus understand who and what he was and what his ultimate theological significance was, say, in mid-career?
My answer would not be terribly different. I'm reminded of Paul's statement, where he says, "Not beyond the things that are written." And in many ways, I think we should not go beyond what is written in the text in terms of drawing conclusions. One of the real issues here is, what's it mean to be a human? Can Jesus be fully human and have total knowledge of the universe, omniscience? And I think we have to say no. And so there is this sense of the incarnation in which Jesus is aware of being sent by God, being one in purpose with God, but also the text says learning obedience along the way. A prophet, yes, an understanding beyond what normal human comprehension is, but certainly not omniscient. He would not be human if he were. And so it seems to me that a number of those, you know, I cringe at the language a bit, but the divine attributes are laid aside in order to be fully human.
Does Jesus exist now as Jesus?
Do you mean, does he have a physical body?
I'm not worrying about a body. I'm worrying about identity.
Then yes.
It's an interesting silence here.
Yes.
Well, the way I would answer that question yeah. is that Jesus most certainly does exist, but not in the same way in which he existed as a physical human being in first century Palestine.
Sure.
And so I think one of the texts that helps open that up is in the resurrection appearance story to Mary Magdalene at the empty tomb in John's Gospel, in John chapter 20, verse 17, where the risen Christ appears to Mary at the empty tomb and points her toward the disciples. He says to her, "Don't cling to the me, do not cling to me." Mm-hmm. And I think what he's saying to her is, don't cling to the way that you knew me as an earthly human being. He says, but go to my brothers and sisters and tell them. And so he's pointing her toward the gathered community, and it's there that Christians experience him alive in their midst, mm-hmm. is in the gathered community of believers.
We are about to pause for the usual reason, and then directly to the phones. I see all the lines are taken. That is a matter of no surprise. If you're trying to reach us, you're getting the busy signal. But the proper strategy, of course, is to try again right after we say goodnight to some prior caller at 312-591-7200. And for Internet listeners, wherever they may be, the best way in is via email. The email address, again, extension 720 at wgnradio.com. On to your contributions, query or concept or attestation. After we pause for this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly to the phones for your questions and comments to Barbara Reed and Klein Snodgrass after a quick reintroduction of those guests. Barbara Reed is professor of New Testament Studies and is vice president and academic dean at the Catholic Theological Union here in Chicago. She is a Dominican sister. Klein Snodgrass is the Paul Brandel Professor of New Testament Studies at North Park University. And with that, we go to the phones, 312-591-7200. And first up is Lee. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. Not too long ago, Melt, you had several Mormons discussing their religion. With Mitt Romney's Mormonism being prominent, it keep coming up during the campaign for the presidency, I was wondering if your guest scholars could explain why, for numbers of Christians, particularly fundamentalists, they are exercised about Mormonism and regarded as something as being apostasy. And I'll hang up and listen.
Stay in there rather than hang up. Let's certainly address that. Klein Snodgrass.
I really think that oppose Romney just because he's a Mormon is inconsistent. Other candidates are not opposed merely because they're a secularist or of some other particular religion. I don't think that those kinds of concerns ought to drive someone's choice. I do think issues of character and morality and things like that are crucial, obviously. But I would not think that Romney should be blackballed just because he's a Mormon.
I agree with you, but I was wondering if you could kind of help edify a little bit here as to what the theological differences are that many fundamentalists take great exception theologically.
An easy way to Mormonism. Put that might be simply to ask quite directly, do you consider Mormonism a denomination of Christianity?
I think that's a difficult question. From the standpoint, to the degree that someone is holding up the Book of Mormon and fully invested in the what I would say are the more extreme parts of Mormon theology, then you start to worry. But I'm sure there are a good number of Mormon people raised in a Mormon context, and they view themselves as the Latter-day Saints of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And I'm not the judge of other people.
Are you familiar with the Book of Mormon?
Yes, but not recently.
I was wondering if you have some thoughts about it compared to what your beliefs are. We're talking about the historical Jesus tonight, so that's why.
That's right. And
I'm not trying to give you a hard time, but everybody's being so diplomatic. I'm just trying to understand what the substantive differences are, if there are.
Well, it's quite true that in the Book of Mormon we have Jesus visiting and being actively involved in affairs on the North American continent.
Which I think there's no basis for. We're so far removed from the historical Jesus, I don't even know how to go there.
Yeah. Our thanks to the caller, and that's as much as we can do with that. Tonight we go quickly to the next, and here is Mark, who joins us. Good evening, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening. Judas played a very important role in the life of the historical Jesus, and I want to preface my questions by saying that I don't personally believe that Jesus was omniscient, and the reason for that is simple matters of upbringing as a child and so forth. I don't believe he came out of the womb speaking perfect Aramaic, and I don't believe that the realities of learning a trade from his father and learning at his mother's knee would have been possible if he had started out omniscient. I do believe that he was able to get whatever knowledge he needed through his communion with the Father. Now, having said that, I wonder, first of all, if Judas had any choice about the role he played. Predestinarians would say that he didn't. I would say that betrayal is an inevitable counterpart or backlash in the redemption story, and if it hadn't been Judas, it would have been someone else. And then my second question is, if Jesus was omniscient, why would he allow a rogue disciple to stay in the band of disciples the whole time? My own personal answer to that is that Jesus always held out the hope that Judas might have second thoughts and reverse his plot, and that still somebody else would have done the betrayal if Jesus hadn't. But I'd like to know what the panel thinks about all this.
Yes, very well put, and let's get a response. Let's go to Barbara Reed.
Thank you for your question and your comments. As I expressed a little while ago, I don't think that the earthly Jesus was omniscient. And as far as Judas having a choice, most certainly, all human beings have the choice whether to accept or reject what God is offering to them. And so for Christians, it is through Jesus that we are offered the friendship with God and the intimacy with God. And I think you're absolutely right that Jesus always held out hope, not only for Judas, but for everyone, that there was always a possibility. That's what conversion, that's what metanoia, the turning around, is all about. There's always the hope, that hope is never cut off. There's always the possibility. I think that in terms of Judas, the gospel writers remember the deep, deep pain this was for the community, that it was one of them, one of their own, the closest ones. And remember, it's many decades later that they're telling the story and put it onto Jesus' lips that he knew or suspected which one was the one. But it was it's a very human portrayal of how the story of his life ends. And I think for believers today, it's a powerful story when people experience betrayal in their own lives to be able to identify with how that was for Jesus when one of his very closest friends and followers was the instrument that put all of the events in motion toward that final day.
The reason I asked about the predestinarian element is that some Presbyterians, for example, would hold that Judas didn't have a choice because it was all predestined anyway. I don't share that view, but thank you for commenting on it. And I wonder if Klein has anything to say.
I would agree that Judas has a choice. I think there's a great deal of mystery involved in the interrelation between God and humans in terms of whatever we do. I'm reminded of a statement that a woman New Testament scholar made: God assists people in the choices they make, which is a scary thought on the one hand. But I would be a little different than Barbara in saying, yes, I do think Jesus knows what's going to happen, but he still holds out the hope and the reality that Judas will not do what Judas did. But I do not think that things are predetermined and people do not have choice. It just does not seem
and
to fit.
And is it Calvinist doctrine that everything we do is predetermined, or merely that what is predetermined is whether we're going to the place above or the place below?
I'm no Calvin scholar. I think Calvin gets labeled with a lot of things that Calvin would be uncomfortable with.
Yeah.
I think there is, even with Calvin himself, more room in that discussion. With later Calvinist followers, I think things become more structured and solidified.
Mm. Our thanks to the caller, who, of course, really has raised the ultimate question, which preoccupies even people like me, mere psychologists, which is there volition in human behavior, or is it all, in fact, if we knew all the variables and had all of them in their proper measure, is it all, in fact, predictable and predetermined because it's a cause-effect kind of continuity?
And you're back again to a question we alluded to a moment ago as to what's it mean to be a human being? And if a human being is something that is programmed, I think it's something far less than any of us think or hope or even can accept.
Yeah.
Also, if things are programmed to that degree, where's responsibility? And so while I am strongly in favor of emphasizing the sovereignty of God, I also want an equal focus on the free will of humanity, knowing that there are aspects of life that are predetermined. And we're not talking about absolute freedom when we talk about freedom of the will. But I do think people have choices that they are responsible for.
The so-called Turing test becomes relevant. If you could so program a computer that placing it behind a screen together with a human behind another screen, if you can't tell the difference between the one and the other, then you've created the equivalent of a human being, and you've done it all with the casuistry of modern electronics.
Yeah.
And that would suggest that free will is an illusion.
Right.
But no one... But I don't think the Turing test has yet been properly passed by a serious hominoid computer, so to speak.
Let's hope it never is.
We're into another realm here with this. And we'll thank the caller for that contribution. And we will go to the WGN newsroom on time for once for an update from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And quickly back to Barbara Reed and Klein Snodgrass. You remember early in the program, I quoted a Roman emperor whose name I couldn't remember saying, "Galilean, thou hast conquered." Somebody tried to put down Christianity. I'm helped by a regular listener to the program, Edward, who is a professor of history at a college near New York City, who emails me and reminds me quite correctly it was Julian the Apostate, Constantine's nephew, who reigned from 361 through 363. With that, back to the phones, 312-591-7200. And next up is Diane. Good evening.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure.
With regard to Jesus knowing who he was, he said two things. I must be about my Father's business. And when he was dying on the cross, he said, "Father, Father, why hast thou forsaken me?" Do your guests not think that he knew what he was about?
Of course he knew what he was about. That's quite different than being than saying he's omniscient. The question is whether he could be omniscient and be fully human. He knows what he's about. I think the lament from the cross, the use of Psalm 22:1, is actually an interesting quotation from the Old Testament. Jesus sees himself as the righteous sufferer doing the will of God. I don't think that he sees himself as abandoned by God, but he certainly feels the turmoil and the pain of death. Does he know what he's about? Yes, he knows precisely what he's about.
Well, what about the other quotation, "I must be about my Father's business"?
No problem. That's exactly the same kind of thing. When I made my statement earlier, I tried to emphasize the unity of purpose between Jesus and his Father. He knows he's the one who's sent from the Father. And in John's language, John, in effect, says what the Father says, Jesus says what the Father, what Jesus hears from the Father, he communicates to people. And so there is a unity of purpose there that is, in my mind, unquestioned.
Okay.
I would agree with that, that Jesus is absolutely focused on what is God's business, what God has sent him to do, to be about life to the full for all, as he says in John 10:10. And that is absolutely what drives his entire life. But what the particulars are about how he fulfills the Father's business is something that unfolds step by step for him, as it does with any human being. But he is the one who's able to show us what the free will to choose, what is of God. He's the one that over and over and over shows how one goes about doing that, how one is authentically human, focused on God.
Our thanks to the caller. Excuse me, ma'am. I'm sorry, you have more to say? Go ahead, please.
I was just going to say, but you don't think then he was referring to my Father as God?
Yes, of course he was.
Okay.
And with that, we do thank you for the call. I want to read you an email I have from a regular listener in Australia. This is Mike in Sydney, who says, in recent times, there seems to be an interesting movement occurring. A growing number of Jewish scholars, like Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, author of Kosher Jesus, are reclaiming the Nazarene as one of their own, while Gentile Christians are belatedly discovering the Jewishness of Jesus, or Yeshua, as he is known in the Hebrew language. Do your guests have an opinion on this significant trend? Highest regards, Mike in Sydney.
I think this is a very important aspect of Jesus studies that is especially helpful to Christians who have so many misconceptions about Judaism. And another book that I found extremely helpful is the book by Amy Jill Levine, The Misunderstood Jew.
Who has been on this program discussing that very book, yes.
Yes, and I find it so helpful for Christians who don't get all the fine nuances of Judaism and then tend to misread what we find in the Gospels about Jesus. And I think this is an extremely helpful trend in New Testament studies.
I would agree entirely. One of my complaints is that the Christian church often has not done justice to its own gospel. And one of the reasons it has not done justice to the gospel is that it's not done justice to the story of Israel in which the gospel takes place.
We go back to the phones. John is next up. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Milk. I want to talk about Jesus, who is fully human and fully divine, two full will, two full knowledge. When he went home at age 12, it was the experimental knowledge that he grew in, not the beatific knowledge or the infused knowledge. It was his experimental knowledge that he grew in. Isn't that beautiful?
A moment ago, I used the expression, not beyond the things that are written. And I don't find that kind of division in knowledge something that is part of the text. I would remind all of us as well how much the church has struggled to talk about the two natures of Jesus. And I think it is an extremely difficult area to talk about theologically, but it's not a place that the Scripture focuses on. So I think we ought to be very cautious about what we say.
I would agree with you, Klein. And I think in historical Jesus studies, one of the things that has been recouped is a stronger emphasis on the human Jesus. And why I think that is an important aspect is that if we can write off Jesus as, oh, well, he was God, and then if I can make Jesus unlike me, then it makes it easier for me not to have to imitate him as a Christian. It's far more challenging if he was fully human and he is enabling me to become fully human in like manner and totally focused on God as he was. Then it's a far greater challenge for a Christian.
May I add at that point? Christians talk about Jesus as being the revelation of who God is, and it's perfectly correct. But Jesus is also the revelation of what the character of a human ought to be. And we need the dual focus. And Barbara is right. If you end up with what historically is called a docetic Jesus, one in which the humanity is denied or minimized, he puts no real pressure on you. He can be righteous because he's the Son of God. No, he's a human, manifesting God, yes, but doing the will of God as a human. And we need to take that seriously and be challenged by it.
Our thanks to the caller. Do you take the following seriously? I read from something I just went seeking. I couldn't remember all the names. But I speak of the new atheists, and I read from Wikipedia. The term is commonly associated with individuals such as Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, and the late Christopher Hitchens, who together were called the Four Horsemen of the New Atheism. And they are serious guys, and pretty knowledgeable about religion generally, and about Christianity most particularly. And they really represent the guardians, or in some sense the leaders, of a whole sector of modern Western individuals. By Western, I mean us, and I mean Western Europe and so on, for whom faith has died. Because that's been a recurring crisis in Christianity. The Victorians went through much the same over 100 years ago, but 150 years ago. But I knew some of these. I know Richard Dawkins, and I knew Christopher Hitchens. And both of them surely argue that essentially this is all myth work, which we ought to get beyond. The atheist position hasn't changed much. It's that men delude themselves with some very tricky stories, and that pays off psychologically. But, well, Sigmund Freud did the very same in his book, The Future of an Illusion, that as we grow older and wiser, we put aside childish things, and these are the childish things. I know you don't believe that. Even I don't believe that. But what does a serious Christian say, particularly drawing back to the New Testament or Scripture generally? What does such a person say to, say, a Richard Dawkins?
I think you have to say, first of all, that again, that the Christian church has not done justice to its own gospel. We have, I think, sold a form of the gospel that doesn't embrace the depth of what the gospel is really about, which gets summarized in Paul's language with dying and rising with Christ. If you ask me, what's this about and why should we take it seriously? I think I would say, first of all, Jesus and his resurrection offers a view of life, a vision of life that's worth living. And without it, without the focus on resurrection and transforming power of God's Spirit to make humans what they're supposed to be, this life doesn't have a whole lot that really makes sense or gives purpose or gives any reason why I should care about anybody else. But all of a sudden, with a gospel that takes seriously life with God, walking with God, being able to, you know, Jesus says, if you're going to follow after me, deny yourself, take up your cross, and start marching behind me. And all of a sudden, you have a reason not to be self-centered, not to have life centered around yourself, but to realize that you're part of a community, that you live as community, and we're only as good as we invest in each other, doing the will of God. So all of a sudden there's a purpose for life that without that I don't see.
Well, now, does all serious established religion render that same service against the relapse into mere solipsism, to mere narcissism? Or is it Christianity particularly that does that best for us?
I would say there's something about the cross and the resurrection that is different. Here you come with a Jesus who is not trying to come as the powerful warrior. He comes and washes the feet of his disciples. He comes and says, the one who's trying to exalt him or herself will be lowered, and the one who lowers him or herself will be raised. And all of a sudden you have a different approach to life. It's not about me and my stuff. It's about the will of God, living in community.
Very well said. Barbara Reed.
It's all another comment I would make on this question is that the argument about giving up childish things, I would react very strongly to that, that as Klein has described, living the challenge of the Gospels is hardly a childish thing. It's not for children. This is a very challenging life to take up, and it's and why some let it go and why others continue to embrace it. And in some ways, it's difficult to explain. We could use the language of gift faith is a gift, and it's difficult to explain what disposes a person to receive that gift and what closes a person off from receiving that gift. For me personally, it would be hard to understand how you would find meaning and purpose in life without faith.
However, it is a simple social fact that in the modern world, the place where the gift has been most fully withdrawn, or where, in fact, serious commitment to Christianity has been fading away, is Western Europe. I don't know why.
Yes, and
I
here
think
too.
That needs accounting.
Here too, the fastest growing religion in this country is no religion.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a phenomenon now.
But that's why I say the church stands guilty, because we've not done justice to our own gospel. And there are a fair number of people who are saying this kind of thing now. If you look, the typical way the gospel gets presented is, here, you do this, you believe this, you say the right words, and then when you die, you get to go to heaven. And the truth of the matter is, the text doesn't have a whole lot of focus on going to heaven. That's just not where the focus is. And believe me, I think heaven's a perfectly wonderful thing, but it's not where the focus is. The focus is upon life now and eternally with God, and it's about being engaged in the will of God. And when will we get to the point where we stop giving simplistic answers and know that what Jesus is asking for, what this Christian faith is asking for, is an attachment to Jesus that is not part-time and engages your whole being and gives you a purpose and a community, and we'll put you to work. And it's not easy.
We are quite late for our last batch of commercials. We'll go to those and then a few more phone calls.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And back to Klein, Snodgrass, and to Barbara Reed, and to your calls and questions. Next up, Ken joins us. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yeah, good evening. I had a Mormon friend pose this question to me. That is, they believe that there are three individual persons in a Trinity, whereas we Catholics, we believe there are three in one. And he said, well, then who was Jesus praying to in the Garden of Gethsemane? To himself? And I'll hang up and listen to the comments of your panel. Thank you.
All right. That's that sounds like a standard conundrum that kids probably come up with in Sunday school class.
Well, it's important to remember that the doctrine of the Trinity is not articulated in the full form in which we now have it until centuries later. And so Jesus is a Jew who's praying to the God of his that has been revealed to his people. And so he uses a very intimate address to God, at least as the Synoptic Gospels record the scene. Or convey the scene, and calling God Abba, Father, and so he's addressing God in an intimate way, but the doctrine of the Trinity is not articulated, and he is simply being faithful to the God that he knows from the faith of his people, and I'm not sure that it's really a question of. How he understands himself in that. It's the relationship between him and God, not conscious of how this is related to the Trinity.
Here's an interesting email that's just come in. Aside from Richard Dawkins and the new atheists, there's a growing belief, maybe even a shibboleth, among people who consider themselves educated and sophisticated, that Jesus was a mythical figure rather than a historical figure. This belief is common among younger, left-of-center people and has become so prevalent that even Bart Ehrman, a biblical scholar whose loss of faith has made him something of a hero to the new atheists, has written a new book for the explicit purpose of dispelling the Jesus didn't exist narrative. Bart Ehrman's an old friend of ours. He's been here many times. And indeed, that new book has just been published within the last few days. And then the listener asks, what do the guests think of the push to deny the historical existence of Jesus?
Well, it's not a new thing.
Ralph Ingersoll did it, a figure in Chicago back at the turn into the 20th century.
Right.
He's a famous American atheist.
Right, and at least has a history of a couple hundred years.
Yeah.
So it's not anything new, and I don't know any, I shouldn't say, don't know any, I hardly know any scholar who takes this approach seriously. You have to have something that launches the missile of the church and of Christianity. And as we indicated earlier tonight, there are all kinds of messianic pretenders in the first century. There's not a group of followers that continues after the death of any of them. Furthermore, there are, they're not many, but there are historical evidences by Jews, Josephus most importantly, although his witnesses most people accepted has been added to by Christians, but initially there was a witness by Josephus, and Tacitus and Suetonius, and Serapion, Bar Serapion also refers to Jesus. One of the ones that I think is most interesting is actually a graffiti that comes from Rome, the Alexamenos graffiti. It's a graffiti that was scratched into the wall of a donkey's head on a cross, maybe as early as late first century. But, you know, there is this evidence that's there that cannot be gainsaid. And focus much time on saying Jesus didn't really exist really doesn't deserve our time.
Well, some of the evidence you're talking about, though, is evidence that the Christians as a movement existed. And
yes.
Surely that's true. When Pliny writes back to Trajan, he says, I've got all these Christians out here,
yeah.
And I don't know what, should I kill them or what?
Yeah. That's Pliny. Tacitus and Suetonius both explicitly mention Christus.
They mention the Christians in Rome and say they are believers that Christus somehow was their God.
Yes, so there's the evidence there.
Yeah.
And but the there's enough evidence there that to deny the person of Jesus, I mean, within a very short period, you have a major movement. Now, it's not impossible that you can have a movement without a leader, but that you would have a group gathered around a crucified leader, you're really stretching.
Yeah.
The thought.
Well, I think it is established beyond any possible question that that historically a man, Jesus, did exist.
Yeah.
And he had some very special claims.
Yeah.
Which people took very seriously. Surely that is true. And I don't think even Richard Dawkins would deny that. Let's see, we can work in one more quick call. And let's go directly to Marvin. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Rosenberg and your guest. I just wanted to say that I wholeheartedly believe that Jesus Christ was put into this earth through the Holy Spirit, and I just wanted to touch and agree that he was fully man and he was God. Also, he knew that he was God and that he was instructed through a higher power, which was his Father. And as being the Son, he was obedient to the fullest, and I just wanted to mention that. If you had a theological analysis of it, I would like to agree with that.
We thank you, sir, for the call. As we close, and we will need to do that within the next few minutes, there's a lot of scholarship. You both represent that scholarly community studying the New Testament. What is available for the common reader rather than for the specialist that you would recommend along those lines? Nothing?
One of the problems is there's such a voluminous amount of literature.
Yes, that's why I'm surprised that you
start.
I see.
And I would say, unfortunately, a good deal of it ought to be filtered. I would say that there are any number of good commentaries on scripture texts. There are any number of good books. One of the things that's quite helpful these days, a number of publishers are publishing books, five views on this, five views on that, and people can get a perspective across the board in a hurry. Those kinds of books are helpful, but there are major publishers that we deal with all the time. Many of them are in Grand Rapids, Erdman's, Baker, mm-hmm. Zondervan here in our area, InterVarsity.
But is there any particular volume that gives you a good summary of what New Testament scholarship has been up to in recent years?
Well, one that I mentioned earlier that I think that I'd say again is A Misunderstood Jew, which really helps.
Amy Jill Levine,
yeah. HarperCollins. I think that really helps Christians who don't understand Judaism well.
I would just add most of the writings of N.T. Wright.
Uh-huh.
He just covers all kinds of this stuff, and he's very capable. People will find that helpful.
And with that, we close for the evening. Our guests have been, and wonderful guests they have been indeed, Lyon Snodgrass, who is professor of New Testament studies at North Park University, and Barbara Reed, who is the same at the Catholic Theological Union. And with that, we will wind down for the evening. I'm going to be away for a few days, just taking a little bit of vacation time and pursuing some other matters. But we'll be back again, as I remember it, Wednesday next week. Others will be filling in for me, and some of our broadcasts will be tapes that I've done recently, which you have not yet heard. So until shortly, in fact, until about a week from now, thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.